Så ska jag samla. Är det några extra sheets? Är det några extra sheets? Okay. Erev Tov, it's also a big schuss to teach here, and especially to work under such a big tzaddik. I want to start with a story that my wife told me that she was sent by email that appeared in the New York Times. A few weeks ago, there was a religious woman who obviously attended Shalom for Women and had learned that you're not allowed to put on regular makeup on Shabbos. So she had a big bar mitzvah coming up of her son, and she was trying to figure out what to do. So she researched different makeups, and she got a very well-known company. I think it was said in the Times what it was. You'll see from the story that it was bad advertising. She said, long-lasting makeup, lasts guaranteed to last 24 hours. So Roman said, great, this is it. This is the makeup in question. I'll be able to, you know, have my halacha and my makeup too. And she tried it out. So she put it on a Thursday, let's say at 12 o'clock. And sure enough, Friday already, maybe 7 a.m., 8 a.m., the makeup had already faded. The 24-hour deal had not been fulfilled. So what does she do? She sues the company. So she sued the company in U.S. court for false advertising. You claim your makeup lasted 24 hours. It does not last 24 hours. Of course, the New York Times got a hold of this and had a field day of it and wrote up the article, and probably with some implicit trying to poke fun at Orthodox Judaism, but I can't say I didn't read the article. And of course, this is one of the big mistakes that I make in terms of Bittelsmann, that, you know, when you start reading the talkbacks on articles, I didn't read this one, but my wife was telling me, but I read sufficient talkbacks on other websites. It just goes on and on and on and on. And I can imagine an article like this, especially in the New York Times, so you're going to have talkbacks from everyone. Maybe from some rabbanim, maybe from some people who are Muslim, from some people who are Christian, from some people who are interested in the legal angle, from some people who are interested in the makeup angle, from some people who are interested in the bar mitzvah angle. I'm sure there were a few mazel tovs there. Anyway, this goes on and on. So one of the talkbacks was, yeah, you have to stop false advertising. And another one was, good for you, you know, stand up for your rights. And another one was, I don't think women should really be prohibited from putting on makeup on Shabbos. So, of course, it's pretty dangerous when the New York Times becomes a forum for halachic discussion. But, much as sometimes the Knesset becomes such a forum, but that's not our topic for now. This is the question, I think, that at least at some point in our lives, we should study deeply. What's wrong with that claim? Isn't that part of life, at least part of female life? How does that change, if you will, to quote Tevye from Fiddler on the Roof, some vast eternal plan, if my lips were a little redder on Shabbos? Might not rhyme. That's why a wealthy man is better, but sometimes that has the guise of, does God really care if? You've all heard that before. I mean, and I don't know if any of you have said it, I'll blame myself for it. Does God really care if I take the peanuts and the cashews, or the cashews and the peanuts, or if I use a specialized chopper or a regular chopper, or if I put food into an oven with an ability to adjust the oven, or without ability to adjust the oven, or into a warming drawer with tape or without tape? Pick your malacha and hilchas Shabbos. Pick your detail in other areas of halacha, and one could ask a valid question, not even as a challenge, does God really care if, but why does God care if? And as our Masorah teaches us, and much has been said about this, especially in recent times, that we are a religion of questioning and answering. We learned that from the Haggadah. Very few questions are unfathomable, untouchable. What was the world like before the world was created? That's actually a self-contradiction. What does it mean to just have God around before the world? These are types of questions that the Mishnah Chagiga tells us you're not going to get anywhere, because our whole perception begins post-creation. But outside of those kinds of questions, or what's going to happen after the world is all gone, studying eschatology and in terms of, you know, is there a post-Olam Haba, etc. So there are certain questions that the Rebbe Shem tells us, don't bother, you're not going to be able, you don't have the tools to explore. But most other questions are valid to be asked and to be studied. And Baruch Hashem, having been Zocheh to have been in some way in the world of learning for, never thought I'd be able to say this, but Baruch Hashem, I hope more, but for a few decades, when honest questions are asked and you search for answers, it's unbelievable what you explore and what you see. But in order to be able to pick up on that discovery, it has to be as our ancestors already laid out the framework, Nasa Nishma. As David HaMelech so beautifully puts it, Hareini Neflos Mitorasecha. Show us wonders from your Torah. I'm ready to see the wonders. But that does not prevent us from legitimately asking. Not challenging, does God really care if, but what is the message in the details of mitzvos? And why is that significant? And how does that in any way enhance our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? That, of course, in a very real way, is the difference between the She'ela of the Bein HaChacham on the night of the Haggadah, Moha'edos, V'Chukim, V'Mishpatim, I'd like to understand more deeply. And not the question, as Rav Beis Halevi points out, but really the statement, the attack. I know many of you remember in my past life, you know, so sometimes there were talk shows where someone would get up and say something, you know, when there was a period of question and answer, and then the host would say, is that a question or a statement? And then the person would think about it for a second and say, I guess it's a statement. Said, okay, thank you for your statement. Now let's move on. A lot of times we think we're asking questions, but we're not. We're just making statements. I'd like to share with you a beautiful story that's told in the name of Reb Chaim Brisker. Again, this is more of a general introduction to questioning rather than challenging, which I think is so important in order to be able to get that galay nai v'abita neflaos mitorah secha. Let's be able to see wonders from Torah. So Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was once asked, so the story goes, can't call it a chassidish ma'isa because it's in the world of brisk, so I guess it's a brisk ma'isa, which again may or may not be true, but a point is very, very correct. That an apikoros once came to him and said, Rebbe, I got lots of kashis on the religion. If you can answer them, I'll go back to Shmiras HaMitzvos. If you can't, then I know the religion's wrong. So Reb Chaim briefly looked at the list. He turned to the fellow and said, tell me, you came up with these questions after you smoked the first cigarette on Shabbos, or before? So he smiled, and he said, well, to tell you the truth, Rebbe, first the smoking came. He said, aha! Then these are not questions. These are answers. These are terutzim. These are terutzim as to why you think it's justified to smoke a cigarette on Shabbos. Terutzim for terutzim I don't have. Answers for answers I don't have. I only have answers for questions. Come back to me when you're ready to ask questions, and then we'll discuss. And I think that's a very, very powerful message. And I think, you know, that little blurb on the Times, obviously, you know, can't darshan what Bob says, you know, from Wichita in the talk back of the Times. But many of us, and I think, you know, as we always say, religious growth is incremental. We all have a Yetzirah that talks that way, like Bob from Wichita, whether that's his name or not. We all have the Russia within us, so to speak, the Bein HaRusha that tries to challenge. But when we do that, we don't get anywhere. Because then Hashem does not give us the wherewithal to get answers to our legitimate questions. So in that regard, I wanted to discuss, as the title indicates, the big picture, small details, Klalei HaTorah V'Diktukei HaMitzvos, based on what I've heard from my great Rebbeim, sometimes orally, sometimes in writing, and just as an advertisement, I don't know if the girls got wind of this wonderful, wonderful book here that's lying on the shelf. I don't know if anyone has used it before. Aspaklaria. This is an absolute knockout sefer. It's hashkafa work, arranged from aleph to tuf. So you pick a topic like, Hoshea, Hanhoga, Historia, Shoftim, Hesped, Histapkus, or Mitzvos, which is where I looked in preparation for this year. I knew there were sources there, and I knew approximately what I wanted to say, but I wanted to give you over some serious sources. So he quotes from Zohar, quotes from Gemara, quotes from Midrashim, quotes from Hasidic Sforim, quotes from Nefesh HaChaim, from, as we'll see, from Rabbeinu Bechaya, from the Shalom HaKadosh, an unbelievable research tool. And then, lo and behold, I wanted to find out who wrote this, when was it written, so I typed in Aspaklaria on the internet, and guess what I came up with? The online version of Aspaklaria. Unbelievable. So now I can just cut and paste it. How did you put this together? Just a few clicks of the mouse. So on the shelf, you only have half the volumes, because Mrs. Blank mentioned she wasn't able to get them without a print, but it's in print online. Take a look. Mamash, unbelievable. I'm teaching a little bit about Gilgul and spooky topic in eschatology class, the life of the death class. Most of the Makoros I got are straight from Aspaklaria. So let's share a little bit of that Aspaklaria, that window of Torah wisdom, to the class. A lot of it is also based on a very important shiur that was published by Rav Michael Rosenzweig from Mishu University a long time ago, probably back about maybe 18 years ago, by around Shavuos. YU used to, maybe still does, puts out a weekly publication, Divrei Torah on the Parsha of the Week, or on the Moedim, called Inayim LaTorah. And so Rosenzweig wrote an article, and that began my journey with this whole topic about the interface between, let's call it, the bigger picture of Judaism and the details, and how the details are very, very important. Not supplanting the bigger picture, but our co-relates to that idea. Also, I want to thank a student who I shall not quote directly, not to embarrass her, whose question today actually inspired me to change the topic that I wanted to speak about tonight. Okay, we start with the Medrash Tanchuma in Source 1. Surprisingly, in Parshas Noach, Eila told us Noach, Yisborach Shmo Shal Melech Malchi Amlochim HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shebochar BiYisrael Mishivim Umos Kemo Shekosov Ki Chelek Hashem Amo Yaakov Chevel Nachlaso. Praised is God who chose the Jewish people from all the nations of the world. V'nosan lano es HaTorah B'chsav. He wrote the written, he gave us the written Torah. B'remez. That written Torah alludes to much other depth besides that which is written. Tzfunot ustumot. Seemingly, at least at first glance, hidden and sealed away. Upershum. And explain those mysteries, and explain those hidden items, b'Torah Shebalpe, in the oral law. V'gila osam l'Yisrael. And reveal them to Israel. V'lo od. Ela Torah Shebichsav klalot. The written law are generalities. The Torah Shebal Peh, Pratot. The oral law represents details. The Torah Shebal Peh, Harbei. The Torah Shebal Peh is a lot. Look at Shas, over 2,000 pages. That's just the Bavli. And then the expansion of Shas with the commentaries, much more. Tanakh, one book. I think they have a book now, Shas Bavli, Bikrach Echad, but you have to have like 8 pages on one side in order to put it in one volume. Not only the Torah, but the whole Tanakh fits into one book. The Torah Shebal Peh, even that which we have recorded, and there's much more to the Torah Shebal Peh than that, takes up a whole bookshelf. That's the old joke in marriage. Usually, in many circles, the chassan gets a present of a Shas from his future father-in-law. So in the standard bookshelf that you have at home, so the Shas fits exactly into, the big Shas fits into one shelf, except for one volume. I don't know what the drush is, but that's the, you have to put one on one another shelf. You never finish learning, I guess. Or maybe it teaches you that it's not just for looks, you have to learn it. It doesn't fit perfectly. Some people pick Svarim by color or coordination. Torah shebichsav ma'at, v'al shebal peh ne'emar arucha me'eretz midah. It's greater than the land. Uruchava miniyam. It's wider than the sea. Skipping a little bit. Shelo timtza Torah shebal peh. I skipped about four lines in the underlines. Shelo timtza Torah shebal peh eitzami shemavakish oneg ha'olam. Ta'ava v'kavod v'dula b'olam hazeh. Someone who's interested in just self-pleasure, you're not going to really get someone who's successful in mastering the Torah shebal peh. Ela b'misha meimis atzmo aleha. The famous idea concerning the Torah study, someone who kills himself over it. Shenemar zos haTorah adam ki yomis ba'ohel. Rav Eliashiv, as is well known, got up every morning at 2 a.m. He went to sleep at 10. You would think he went to sleep at 10, maybe he went to sleep at 7. No, he went to sleep at 10, and he woke up at 2. Then he learned till Vasikin, daven with a minion, took like an hour and a half nap, and that was it for the rest of the day. The Gra, they say, slept 1 hour. Do you understand why these people are gedolim? Sometimes people say, well, my rabbi says this way. Different rabbanim are entitled to their opinion. But it's important in terms of getting a perspective, in terms of the difference, in terms of the mastery of Torah that gedolei Yisrael have. But that's not a topic for now. Let's continue. The first one in the line is V'Torah. See what it says, Shmos Lamedalad, so we back up two lines. After the comma, Lefisha lo karas HaKadosh Baruch Hu brisim Yisrael ela ha-Torah shebal peh. The treaty was made, the eternal bond with God was made over the Torah shebal peh. Shenemar ki al pi hadvarim ha-ele. Based on the oral tradition, the al pi, on the mouth of these words literally. Skipping a little bit. You see where it says Shoftim Hay toward the end of, I should have numbered the lines, Shoftim Hay, about maybe 20 or so lines down. So now we have Velo. Velo kiblu Yisrael es haTorah at shekof aleim haKadosh Baruch Hu har kigigis. Famous Medrash. They didn't accept the Torah till Hashem forced them. Sheneemar v'yishatzu b'sachti sahar. V'amar avdimi barcham, v'amar lehem haKadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael v'mkavam atem es haTorah mutav v'mlav sham tekuraschem. If you accept the Torah, great. If not, not so great. So now, the Medrash Tanchuma asks the famous question, what happened to Nasav and Ishma? Wasn't that a willful acceptance of the Torah? Why does the Medrash record this oral tradition that the Torah was forced upon Klal Yisrael? V'im tomar al haTorah shebichsav kof aleim asahar. If you're going to tell me that it was over the written Torah that they were forced to accept it. V'alo misha sham lehem kablam atemes haTorah anu kulam v'amru nasav nishma. So what's the Medrash answering to that famous question of how do you put together the willful acceptance of Torah nasav nishma and the forced acceptance of kaf aleim har kigigit? What is the Medrash Nachuma's answer? I never knew this before. Rabbi Rosenzweig opened my eyes concerning this Medrash. Torah shebichsav? Yes, boss. Whatever you say. Torah shebal peh? Got to think about that one. Well, sorry, you already signed the Torah shebichsav. It's a package deal here. Either accept it or else. So the Medrash continues. Why did they accept the Torah shebichsav so willfully? So willingly? Mipnei she'ein bo yigi'ah v'tzar. Because it has no toil. It has no pain. V'hima'at. It's just a little bit. Even though the Medrash seems to be focusing on learning, but Rabbi Rosenzweig extended this Medrash that it's also referring to action. And I think that's a very powerful point. Ela omalehen ala Torah shebal peh sheyesh bo dikdukei mitzvot. Kalot v'chamorot. All kinds of details. Some of them easy. Some of them difficult. And now look at this phraseology. If someone would write this nowadays, they'd put up a sign in Meir Shar and branding them as an apikoros. The azok hamavis. It's as harsh or as strong as death. Oh, what fantastic phraseology here. V'kosha k'sh'ol k'nosa. Why such strong terminology? V'fisha ein lomed osa el amisha o'ev HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'chol libo v'chol nafsho v'chol ma'odo. Only someone who truly loves Hashem will dedicate their efforts to trying to absorb that, and as Rabbi Rosenzweig, I think, added, to fulfill it. Let's put it in a somewhat of a different perspective. My Rebbe Rav Blachman, Rav Mendel Blachman from Keren B'Yavne, an enormous, enormous Talmud Chacham. I don't know, I was in his shir for a while. He used to bring like 50 proofs to every idea he developed in Gemara. My head was hurting after the shir. I had to bail out after a while. I went to a different shir. But he was famous for getting us together in, offline, so to speak, at the Malava Malka or something, at an Oneg. And then we would sing some Nigunim, and then he would give like an hour schmooze, and it was just, we felt like we were flying in the upper worlds after we heard this. And he was also very sarcastic, so that kind of helped a little bit. I guess you have to be boys for that, but... So, one of the things that that I heard from him... was, right now I don't remember because I lost my train of thought, but we'll get it in a moment, I hope, Ezrat Hashem. Well, come back to me. Let's try to modernize this. Oh yes, exactly. He said, boys, once in a while you just got to take the King James Bible and just read it. Like, what are you talking about? So what he meant in his way was, sometimes you got to read the Torah in your own language and pick up the message. Pick up the Bible and start reading. In the beginning, God created the world, and keep reading in just a few days or maybe even a few hours. See what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was trying to give over to you. So he was obviously referring to what is the only testament, what another religion calls the old one. But that was his way of saying, read it in English. Because sometimes, especially from a Shiva boy perspective, so you're learning this Rashi with the Ramban, and how he learns, and how this one learns, and how they're different, and all the Hevdelim. But what's the message that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving over to you? He's giving us a message. Sometimes you miss that message if you don't read it fast, if you read it so slowly. That's perhaps one of the reasons that Parshas HaShavua is so crucial, even without commentary. They just read it, they used to translate it, for whatever reason that has fallen out of practice now, to get the message, at least within a year, people should have the Torah. So let's take some samplings here. So, how do you keep Shabbos as far as the Torah Shavuot Chasav is concerned? You've all learned this, both in class and your own. What does it say?
No fire.
No fire is the only thing mentioned there, right? Al yetzi shem komo. Don't leave your spots, okay? Don't walk outside the tchum, perhaps a reference to. And what is the core statement of Malacha? What does it say? Don't do work. Okay, I know what that means. I don't get on the subway, I don't get into my car, I don't drive to work. But I do get into my car and drive to the park. I do turn on the television. I do type to my computer. I do write a note to my friend. That's work? That's why all of the Sfarim, the contemporary Sfarim and Halachot Shabbat, they always have an introductory line to say, what's Malacha? What's Avoda? Malacha is creative activity, even if it doesn't have toil. Even if you move a couch from one place in the house to the other, that's not Malacha. Again, to redecorate your house, at least to be over the chol, but it's not awesome in a Torah. But to turn on a light switch, skila. People don't understand. Do you think God really cares if... I could understand, He wants us to rest. Okay, everyone knows, nowadays America is more machmir, sveik of the yoma. Saturday and Sunday, you have to have a day of rest. Israel's also working toward that. The banks already have moved over to that system. It's good for Shomer Shabbos, and Baruch Hashem, that happened in America. L'sasaka malacha. Okay, boss, no problem. We won't go to work on Shabbos. There's a catch. Don't pick up that almond over there if you don't want it. That's skila too. Many of you are learning about Libun. I hope to be able to teach it before the year's up. See that stain on your garment? Don't you dare put water on it. That's skila also. What? Does that make any sense? We're not interested in this. Too late. Kofalim harkigigis. It's a package deal. You can see why Klal Yisrael didn't want to accept it? It's the same claim. Same claim as Bob from Wichita. I think women should be able to put on makeup on the Sabbath. What's the big deal? And the same, of course, could be said about many of the other mitzvot HaTorah. If we take that approach that Rav Lachman suggested, what major themes do we pick up in the Torah? Shabbos is one of them. It's probably mentioned about at least 10, maybe 20 times in the Torah. What else is a major theme? If you could, that's repeated again and again in the Torah. Loving God, yes, certainly. Yitziat Mitzrayim again and again and again. What else? Briyat HaOlam, interestingly, as the Kuzari points out, well, not so much. I mean, it's certainly discussed in Bereishis. It's mentioned in Seres HaDibros. But I don't know if you have, I mean, it'd be an interesting study to explore, but it seems there's more Yitziat Mitzrayim in the Torah than Briyat HaOlam and the Kuzari made famous, perhaps why. What about mitzvos that are repeated again and again in the Torah, besides Avat Hashem? Avodah Zarah. Ooh, almost every other page. Don't worship Avodah Zarah. As many modern thinkers have said, Avodah Zarah doesn't mean only bowing down to Bubba Shmubba. Right? It also means bowing down to greenbacks. It also means bowing down to pleasure. Again, not in terms of skila, but in terms of attitude. That we serve the Ribbono Shel Olam, nothing else in the world. A lot about that. You can understand why. Very fundamental idea. Yiras Hashem. Gratitude. Remember what Hashem has done for you in Mitzrayim, in the Midbar, every day. Remember my Torah. Keep the mitzvos. But when it comes to individual mitzvos, there are very few. And Rav Hirsch and others explore why it is that some mitzvos take up whole parshios. Anyone want to give an example of a mitzvah that takes up a whole parsha? The Mishkan, certainly. Sota, a few psukim, really, not an entire parsha, but what about, what we, you know, let's say the weekly portion? What's a section that takes up an entire parsha, even parshios? Karbonos? Tons of details. There's a lot in the Torah Shebaal Peh, too. But if you just read the psukim, you get a pretty good picture how to bring a karbon. You can't say that for Shabbos. What about saras? I saw Baruch Hashem, the girl struggling with that. That's so many psukim on saras. Yes, there's Torah Shebaal Peh, but you pretty much get most of the picture just from the psukim. Very interesting to explore why the Torah gave the details for that. Perhaps because they focus on broad themes of tahara versus tumah, which is of course relevant to other ideas as well. Karbanot, which is karev, serving a Kodesh Baruch Hu, but it needs its own analysis. Not for now. So we could appreciate this. This is a 3,000-year-old question. It was asked by Klal Yisrael at Har Sinai. Why do you really care if I take the almonds and the pecans instead of the pecans and the almonds? So all the Medrash Tanchuma tells us is that's the way it is. There's a Torah Shebichsav and there's a Torah Shebaal Peh. And it takes a lot more loyalty to buy into the Torah Shebaal Peh than it does into the Torah Shebaal Peh. But it doesn't really answer our question. As to, do we have any nuggets, if you will? Hashkafic nuggets, which is a term that Rabbi Rosenzweig sometimes would use, that we could extract in understanding the ways of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There was a mashal that I read that was quoted in the name of the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Schneerson Zatzal, which went as follows. In response to a questioner, he was famous for writing tons of letters to people from all over the world, and he handled all kinds of topics, questions in halacha, questions in hashkafa, questions about Torah Mada, how do you resolve contradictions between Torah and science. Of course, it's well known that Rabbi Schneerson had a college education. He was in the University of Berlin, together with Rabbi Soloveitchik and the Chama Leibowitz. Parenthetically, I just want to share with you as a sidebar, a story that I heard from my Rebbe, Rabbi Shechter, the name of his Rebbe, Rabbi Soloveitchik. They came out with an article in the New York Times about maybe 10 or 15 years before Rabbi Schneerson passed away, talking about his history and his university years. And they had a line that he was spending his younger years frequenting the cafes of the Berlin scene together with the other young Jewish collegiates. And Rabbi Shechter, those who know him, you rarely see him angry. He's always happy. He's always smiling. Maybe not as, he's not as smiley as Rav Goldwicht, who has like a fixed smile on his face. But always it gives you, and then he came at the share one day, and he read it in the Times Magazine, and he was mamash livid. He said, what kind of schmutz did they write about Rabbi Schneerson in the Times? Carousing the cafes of Berlin with the rest of the Jewish collegiates? You know what the Rav said about Rabbi Soloveitchik when he was in Berlin? When all the Jewish collegiates, even the religious ones, including Rabbi Soloveitchik, were attending class without a yarmulke? I'm not getting involved in that sugya. There's a halachic heter for that. Baruch Hashem now is no longer necessary to rely on that heter in most cases. And when it came time for lunch, were ducking out of class because they didn't want to stand out, and then they ate their lunch wherever it was, you know, on the park bench. Rabbi Schneerson was the only one who dressed like a chassid with a yarmulke, and when it came time for lunch, would stay in the classroom, take his apple out of his brown bag, and say loudly, Borei Priyetz. Wasn't in the cafes. Okay, close parenthesis. It's important to realize with all the hype now about the Lubavitch movement, we're dealing with a great man. Agree, disagree with various presentations, especially about messianism, etc. But so what did he write? So in his day, and just I'll modernize his analogy just a bit. I don't know, I'm getting a little older, so I don't know how old the students were when this happened, but of course you know there were two space shuttles that crashed. So the last one was Challenger, is that the second? So what was wrong with the Challenger? Why did it crash? Anybody read up on this? So they were the Challenger, not for takeoff, but for landing, lands like a plane. It had a few tiles that were a little bit off. They're very heat-resistant tiles that prevent it from burning up on the fast re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere. And there were a few tiles that weren't in place properly. And that's what they felt, based on computer simulations, etc., happened to the space shuttle. Again, the Lubavitcher was talking about something slightly different, but I just wanted to modernize it a bit. So now let's ask the question. Come on. Do the laws of physics really care about a few missing tiles? Give me a break. Why can't it just land without those tiles? And what's the answer? They're rules. They're rules of nature. They're fixed. They have details to them. Let's say I decide one day, you know, I always joke around with my students in Chappelle's because I work there late till like 7 o'clock, so I get home around 8:39. So I'm always muttering under my breath, when are they going to invent molecular transport? Like, come on, like, can't you just bend the rules of gravity a little bit? Can't I just, you know, pop up and just go back to Ramat Beit Shemesh without the regular procedure? Like, would it spoil some vast eternal plan if I were back in Ramat Beit Shemesh 15 minutes after I left? So we all, okay, very nice pipe dream, but those are the rules. What if this is the way of the world? So that's what Rabbi Schneerson said. If we could appreciate that level of detail with respect to nature, should we not expect and also appreciate that level of detail for the blueprint of nature? As you all know, Torah is from which nature was made. Histakel ba'oraisa u'barat ha'olam. It doesn't necessarily answer our question about why those details are important. But if the question doesn't bother us as much with respect to the laws of nature, then should it bother us so intently with respect to the other law system? If I had maybe a few years sabbatical and someone was sponsoring my writing of a PhD, so what I would like to write is a study of comparing the thought of Rabbi Soloveitchik with Rabbi Schneerson. Because in the little that I've read of both of these giants, I saw a lot in common. Just as Samar Makomos, Rabbi Soloveitchik had a famous analysis of the fight between the brothers of Yosef and Yosef himself, and Rabbi Schneerson had a very similar analysis in the Sichos that he gave. And in other ways as well, and one should expect it. You know, great minds tend to think alike and tend to take the Torah data and put it together in similar ways. So Rabbi Soloveitchik is very famous for constantly speaking about the two law systems. He speaks about it in Lonely Man of Faith and other works as well. The natural law and the moral law. One, of course, represented by the name Elohim, and one represented by Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. They're both law systems. Just to quote one example that he gave in that regard, he spoke about it in the famous shir that he gave on Korach. A lot of people, which is related to the does God really care if, ask the following kind of question. This law doesn't make sense. So Rabbi Soloveitchik gave the following analogy. The tie into Korach is that that's what Korach said. Korach said, if a talus is fully blue, do you need a blue string? So Moshe Rabbeinu said, of course. And Korach said, ha ha, that doesn't make any sense. You made up the whole Torah. If there's a room full of svarim, do you need a mezuzah? Of course. Ha ha, that doesn't make any sense. You made up the whole Torah. Again, it might not be our version of, you know, stand-up comic, but basically, and that's why this drasha was called the Common Sense Rebellion Against Torah Authority, the thrust of Korach, which is a very similar thrust, that's mentioned nowadays as well, doesn't make sense. That's the flip side of, does God really care if? So Rabbi Soloveitchik gave the following analogy. It's a little bit, I was marveling at the fact that the man who knew Shas Kol and gave shiurim that floored people knew the science so well, and I didn't even know what he was talking about till I reviewed a little bit my high school physics. He said, tell me. Let me give an analogy. Do things fall because they are heavy, or are they heavy because they fall? Good question. Anybody have an answer to that? They're heavy because they fall. What do you mean? This has weight, it's heavy, so it falls. What are you telling me that it's heavy because it falls? It's heavy, so it falls. In other words, it falls because it's heavy. Things fall because they're heavy. No? Gravity, right? No, so there's weight. Falls, no? So what's the... How come that's wrong? What kinds of heavy things don't fall? When don't they fall? Where do heavy things... Where do things not fall?
Space.
Outer space. Why not? I thought they're heavy, so they should fall. Ah, because they're not heavy in outer space. Ah, so what makes them heavy?
Gravity.
Because they fall, because they're pulled, they have weight. Other than that, they only have mass. What these things mean, you gotta lock yourself in a room and pace back and forth to figure out what this means, but that's the way it is. Does it make common sense? No. Is it reality? Yes. So then he rolled up his mathematical sleeves and said, the gravity equation. G is the gravitational consonant. Little m, big M, over r, the distance to the second potency. I remember the European translation of squared. Aristotle, Paskin science by common sense. Wow, what a discovery. Aristotle claimed that things fall because they're heavy, but he was wrong. He shared that in common with Korach because he did not get to the truth. He jammed in what he thought the truth should be. Newton went back to the books. Let's figure out what's true, whether we like it or not. So then Rabbi Soloveitchik said, if that's true for science, that it doesn't always make sense, it just is. Take it or leave it. Kof aleim har kigigis. That's reality. Should not the halacha have the same prerogative as the scientific endeavor? It's a good tape. bcbm.org. I always tell all my students, download the Korach tape, part one, part two. You gotta have a lot of patience. You gotta listen to it. It's a European accent, but to my mind, it's absolute gold. Absolute gold. It was written up, but it ain't nothing like listening it to the voice himself of the master. So we went a little further. Analogy to nature. Nature has things we don't understand. Torah has things we don't understand. Can we go a little deeper? Is that it? Is that all that human beings are capable of understanding? Let's go a little further. Rabbeinu Bachaye, source 4, in the beginning of Bereishis. Again, this is straight out of Aspaklaria. The whole quote, all I did was put the source from the end to the beginning. V'dor yadua, ki kol mitzvos kulon elokios. Sounds like he's not really saying anything too exciting here. All the mitzvos are godly. Okay, yes, I know, they're given by God. But we'll see in a moment he's saying much more than that. Ushkulot b'mozne ha-chochma. They are balanced in the scales of wisdom. B'nuyot al-adne hadas. We'll skip a little bit. V'taryag mitzvos halolu. Taryag klolim heim. There's 613 mitzvos that all represent general ideas. That sounds like Torah Sheh Bichsav. That's what the Tanchuma speaks about, the general ideas. Ki pirtei ha-mitzvos, the details. The borer, the hachzara, the shahia, the laws of kashrus, basa b'chalav, the binan al-chaveros, all the details of the laws of theft and hashavas aveda. So many details, infinite details even. V'hadas no senes came. So here Rabbeinu Bachaye adds a little more. And it follows that should be so. Ki kevan she'amitzvos elokios. Now we have to translate it somewhat differently. Not just that they're given by God, but since the mitzvos are godly, we'll try to spell that out a little more, what we mean by that. Since the mitzvos are godly, v'kulon morot al chiyuv mitziyot elokuso val yediyoso mitzad drocha v'fulosov. They all indicate the existence of God. And knowing God somehow by analyzing his ways and his actions. Kishem shein tachlit musag lano mitzad yediat pu'lotav. Just like we do not have any kind of ending or any kind of finiteness to understanding his actions in the world. Kach ein tachlit lepirtei ha-mitzvot. So there's no end to the details of mitzvos. How many details of Torah are there? Infinite. Why are there infinite details? Why can't it be a finite amount? Because whose infinity does it reflect? The Ribbono Shel Olam's infinity. The mitzvos are godly. So therefore, their details reflect, way my Rebbe, Rabbi Shechter used to put it in the name of the Baal HaTanya, aspects? Could use such a term of godliness. And just like aspects of godliness are infinite, mitzvos are infinite. This is not light stuff, girls. I don't really understand everything I'm saying, but this is reality. I'm trying to give at least a glimpse as to what it means to do a mitzvah. What it means to desist from an avera. It's not just a good deed. It's not just somehow trying to train yourself in discipline. It's cosmic. It's copying HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We'll go a little further. V'lezeh kivein ha-melech dover alo v'shalom ba'omro l'chol tichla re'isi keitz. To every idea in the world I saw an end. R'chov ha-mitzvos ha-ma'od. But when it comes to your mitzvos, they have no end. They are a reflection of your infinity. The rest of Rabbeinu Bachaye, some of the sources I included more than we're going to get a chance to read. I urge you all, if you get a chance, maybe to study a little more. Let's now skip to source 5. A very curious source that my Tefillah Chavura got a little down payment on. due to the fact that I pressed copy 75 by mistake of the pictures. But fractal. What's a fractal? Some of you have heard of this. Wikipedia defines a fractal as follows. The definition of fractal goes beyond self-similarity per se to exclude trivial self-similarity and include the idea of a detailed pattern repeating itself. Okay, I'll try to translate in a way that I can understand. Let's take a tree, for example. So it's very fascinating. So let's say a palm tree. Here's the way it grows. Branch, 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 all in a circle. Right? And then each branch itself also, not so exciting, just branches out. Take a more complex tree, right? Let's say a tree that has a trunk, and then a branch comes out of there, and then a branch comes out a little higher, and then another branch comes out a little higher. Now take a look at the branches coming out of that big branch. What does that look like? Same. The mini branches of the tree follow the pattern of the big branches of the tree. Which, of course, is a reflection of the programming of the DNA and so on and so forth. In scientific jargon, that's called a fractal pattern. So, just to be a little schmaltzy, on Google, so they came up with pictures of fractals. So it's better in the color. But take a look at the first one, which, what does that look like? Probably such a thing exists similar in nature. It's like a seashell. And if you look very, very carefully, starting from the top, we're talking about a circular pattern that repeats on the mini level, and then on another level, and then on a greater level, and then on a greater level, and a greater level. And then there was a picture, again, it looked much better in color, but of an owl, where within the feathers, there's a mini pattern that repeats on a greater level, and a greater level, till you have the whole feather. Okay, very nice, cute, it's very, you know, nice. They have screen savers that are fractal patterns that, you know, could cause your eyes to get a little dizzy and mesmerized and so on and so forth. What does that do with the shiur? What did Rabbeinu Bachaya say? That each of the 613 mitzvos have infinite patterns. And what I don't think is too difficult to say is that each of the 613 mitzvos branches in the 613 more details, and those branches of the 613 more details, and so on and so forth. Why am I showing you fractals from Wikipedia? Because it's the same legislator. Of course we're going to find a similarity. If Hashem made the world and gave us the Torah, so they're going to be enormous parallels. So just like in nature, it expands and expands and expands and expands, so too in Torah. Okay, a little bit Torah Mada, just to follow my Yeshiva University background. Let's go a little deeper. Source 6, a very famous Gemara. We'll try to end in just a few minutes. Davav Amar Aleph. Fantastic Gemara. Very hard to understand. Amar Rabbi Avin Bar Rav Adam Rabbi Yitzchak Minayin Shehakadosh Baruch Hu Miniach Tefillin.
What?
Everybody's familiar with this idea from Rashi and Chumash. What am I referring to? What Rashi and Chumash speaks about Hashem's Tefillin?
He
wants to see his kavod. Rises achorai. What does Rashi say? What's the achorai? Kesher shel tefillin. What? A big square? A big dalid? What does that mean? This Gemara alludes to this concept as well. Hashem's worth tefillin. It quotes psukim to indicate that this is true. And then the Gemara ends off, quoting Rav Nachman by Yitzchak, second to the last line. Hani. Fill in the Mari Alma Maksiv Bahu. Well, he asked the question, so Rav Chiya Bar Avin answered him, Amarlei, Umi Ka'amcha Yisrael Goya Chadvoritz. What's in our tefillin? Expressions of God's greatness. What's in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's tefillin? Expressions of Klal Yisrael's greatness. Now, one thing I could tell you, whatever this Gemara does mean, which I have no idea, is that the Ribbono Shel Olam does not have a size 7 head, nor a size 8 head, or 10, or 100, or 1,000, or 1,000,000. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not have a head. That's not, according to Shalom HaKadosh, what I just said is not quite true. But he does not have a physical head. So certainly his tefillin is not talking about some gigantic tefillin that are fitting on some gigantic head. So what is the Gemara telling us? So here's my short and sweet answer. I have no idea. But what are we supposed to get out of this Gemara? That's what I'm interested in. That means when a man puts on tefillin, according to Rabbi Kaplan in his work on tefillin, he says that a woman doesn't have to put on tefillin because her whole existence is tefillin. Look in that work, he has a very nice pshat pointing out how a woman doesn't need tefillin because her very spiritual state is tefillin. So when a man puts on tefillin and the woman lives tefillin, what are they doing? They're copying HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What better way to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu than by copying Him? But we're not copying Him in the way Hashem does it, because we can't, because we're not God. So what did Hashem do? So what could I do? This is a big mystery. It's shrouded in Kabbalah. All I could do is try to give a mashal. There was a famous series on television. I don't know if it's still on. A bunch of movies as well, called Star Trek. The older series was much better than the new series. Baruch Hashem, I'm parted from all of that. But the new one was mamish garbage. The earlier one at least had some godless to it. So now, you've all heard of the expression because it became part of the English language, beam me down, Scotty. Right? Molecular transport, what Haber's trying to use to get to Ramat Beit Shemesh. What's happening? You have this like spiritual aura, and then it beams down to become physical. I don't know what I'm saying, but the Ramban says that that's the mun. We learned about it in the morning class. The mun represents spiritual energy that, so to speak, crossed the divide from Ruchnius to Gashmius. It wasn't just, you know, Wheaties from heaven. It was heavenly Wheaties. What does it mean, according to the majority approach, that Malachim can be seen by human beings in human form that Avraham Avinu saw and other tzaddikim are sometimes zochah to see? Same idea. It's the spiritual entity of the Malach crosses over the divide of physicality just a little bit to be able to become, let's call it, just physical. But hardly. So what could I tell you? That's a mitzvah. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us a mitzvah, it sounds a little bizarre, but this is the reality. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us that you're not allowed to take the peanut from the cashew if you want the cashew, but you're allowed to take the cashew from the peanut if you want the cashew, if you want the cashew, I think I got it right, right? What is that? Just blind obedience to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? No. That represents a divine concept. Beam down, if you will, to the world in a way which we could relate to. Because human beings cannot relate to spiritual energy, spiritual ideas, godly abstract concepts. Malachim could do that, not human beings. And that was not the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu for human beings to do that. He wanted them to be able to plug into godliness, even in a physical way. And that's, of course, as you've all heard, the idea of Kiddush HaGashmius, that every single aspect of the world can become holy, but not just in a general way. Every single aspect of the world reflects godliness. Allow me just share with you a little bit of a deep source from the Shalom HaKadosh in Source 7, after the owl. Shaya Levi Horowitz, a famous work, Shnei Luchos HaBris, I always like to say half jokingly that my wife has the initials of the Shalom, except it's not Shalom, but Salo, Sara Le Haber. So, the Shalom HaKadosh says, Nachzor l'inyan, harei mevuar, kimo she'atorah b'sharsho kula shmosav yizborach. Oh, wow. The Torah is all the names of Hashem. He's referring to a very famous Ramban, who says at the beginning of Parshas Bereishis, that the Torah, if you take away all the spaces, and you redivide it in a different way, spells out names of God. I once heard a fascinating idea, that it was that Torah that the Malachim were learning, and that's why they didn't understand when Moshe Rabbeinu went up to Har Sinai how the Torah relates to people. And Moshe had to show them by dividing the letters in a different way. I saw that written up by Rabbi Benjamin Lopez Cardoza. I hope I'm getting all the names right. Beautiful idea. So the Torah represents godliness. V'nishtal shelo, nishtal shel means to be lowered. Zeh l'umat zeh v'nit gashma. What could I tell you, girls? This is the reality. That lofty a concept, the names of God, somehow in some mysterious way. After all, what did Chazal say? He looked into the Torah, created the world. The mystery is right in there. the Torah somehow became, how shall we say, the spiritual concept of Torah became physicalized, crossed over the boundary, and became the mitzvos, became the laws, became the details, became the laws of kashrut, the laws of Shabbat, the laws of tzniut, and yes, the laws of not putting makeup on Shabbos, at least not the Shabbos makeup. You'll ask your local Orthodox rabbi about the Shabbos makeup. It represents a cosmic idea. What cosmic idea? What does that have to do with godliness? The Rebbeinu Shlom hid that mystery. Do you know why? Because we are not capable of understanding the core of it. We're not capable of understanding what it truly represents. When will we be? We spent a lot of time on this in class before Shavuos. That's Gan Eden Shel Malo. That's Olam Haba. That's the Masifta Derekia. That's the Heavenly Academy. That's when you relearn all of those laws in terms of what they represent. Wow! I didn't know that the peanut and the cashew represent so much in the upper worlds, but it does. That's the reality. Again, the Sefer HaTanya says something very similar. We don't have time to go into it. You can take a look at it on your own. Many of you are familiar with the sentence that people throw around without having any idea that what they're talking about, and I don't either, but at least we can get an extra glimpse. Anybody ever hear of the expression, the Torah and God are one? It's a famous expression from the Zohar. What does that mean? On a simple level, you know, it's very bizarre. What, the scroll is God? What does that mean? That's paganism, it's idolatry. So according to what we're learning, we could understand. The Torah reflects the most that we could understand of God. And when we learn Torah, and when we live Torah, we're connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. My Rebbe explained in the name of the Baal HaTanya, the Alter Rebbe Lubavitch, that there's certain mitzvos, I'm sure you've learned about this, that have no physical expression. Anybody know what they are? There's some mitzvos that never happened. They're just theoretical. Bensorah Mor is one of them. Bayis HaMenuga is the second. The leper's house. And the Ir HaNidachas is the third. Very, if you will, unseemly mitzvos. Says the Alter Rebbe Lubavitch, do you know why they can't be lamaisa? Because they represent aspects of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that are so esoteric, that are so out of this world, that Hashem, so to speak, I'm not going to say couldn't, but didn't cause them to cross over the divide. I'd like to end with an idea that I first heard from Rabbi Oldbaum from Queens in the name of the first Belzer Rebbe. I think he was known as the Sar Shalom of Belz. And in that regard, perhaps more personalize this shir to the current audience. Let me start quickly with a vort from Rabbi Lef. Rabbi Lef pointed out that we surround the Kriya Shema with different brachos. Kriya Shema, ultimately, Shema Yisrael, Shema Kenu, Shema Chod, it's the way we get to God. How do we get to God? First bracha, nature. Studying nature. The Rambam, we didn't get a chance to see it inside, says one of the ways to love God and fear God is not just by studying Torah, but by observing nature, recognizing the majesty in nature. Second bracha, Torah. Abba Rabba, Plam Nechugi Chaim, we should keep all the mitzvos. Third bracha, Geula. What do we have here? Three ways to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If everything else about the Shir was maybe in the clouds, it's very down to earth, it could help your tefillah, if you never heard the idea before. Teva, Torah, Geula. We relate to God how? Observing Him in nature, observing Him in Torah, or meeting Him in Torah, and observing Him and how He intervenes in the world. That's Geula. All surrounding Kriya Shema. One of my students in Stern College said that the first two are before, because that's pre, and Geula you only see after. You don't see the hand of God till it's all done. But the others are more forward, I think. So Rabbi Lef pointed out that the first bracha is Teva. Why? Because that comes first. You open up your eyes, you see the world. The second bracha is Torah, because you gotta want to study. Okay, so just picking that up a little bit, and now segueing to what Rabbi Olbam said in the name of the Sar Shalom of Belz. There's a Gemara, there's a Medrash, in Source 9, which you won't read inside. It says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the worlds with the name Ka. Ki Beka Hashem Tzur Olamim. The Yud was used to create Olam Haba, And the hay was used to create Olam Hazeh. Okay, whatever that means, that's what the Medrash comments. So somehow, mysteriously, that letter represents Olam Hazeh. There's another famous Gemara that speaks about the Yud and the Hay. And that's a Gemara in Sota, on Source 10. Just read it quickly, Darash Rabbi Akiva. Ish v'isha, zachu shechina b'nehem. Lo zachu eish al chalta. A man and a woman, if they get married and live in accordance with the Torah and the Shalom b'nehem, they have the Shechina among them. But if not, the Yud of the man is taken away, and the Hay of the woman is taken away, we're left with Eish. That's the way Rashi explains the Gemara. So what do you see from that? That somehow the man is connected more to the Yud, and the woman is connected more to the Hay. At first glance, that sounds very odd. The Yud is Olam Haba, the Hay is Olam Hazeh. What does that mean? The man is more spiritual than the woman. Reverse says the opposite. Reverse says that women tend to more spirituality than the men. So what does that mean? So the Sar Shalom of Bells, the first Bells the Rebbe explained as follows. Baruch Hashem, you've all had the enormous chus and Bezrat Hashem for a lifetime of studying Hashem's Torah. But you're all aware of the somewhat controversial halacha and the Torah, also to be accepted in terms of Nasav and Ishma, not only accepting it, but trying to understand it, that women are exempt from at least many sections of Torah study. Right? You've all heard the ideas, especially those in Michelle's class. Somehow, HaKadosh Baruch Hu programmed into the world that men need Torah study more. The way I once heard it put is that in order for a man to connect to God, he has to some extent leave the world. He has to go into the world of the abstract in order to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In other words, he has to enter Olam Haba, so to speak, in order to relate to God. Perhaps we could say, based on the shir we're developing, the man meets God in the details, in the dikdukim, in the Torah Shebal Peh, which is, of course, the major difference between man's obligation of learning and woman's obligation of learning. Those details, if you will, those constructs, those fractals. And just Baruch Hashem having the schus of teaching in different areas. I teach boys, I teach girls. The types of questions that are asked are a different kind of question. They're all brilliant. I learn so much from my students. But sometimes I discern it's a different type of question. One is more general oriented and one is more specifically oriented. So what the Sar Shalom of Bell said is the following. A woman, by her natural tendencies, is more in tune to be able to connect to God through the hay, through teva. And I want to give an example. These are all prototypes. There are women who act more like men, there are men who act more like women. And if I'm insulting to anybody, please forgive me. Anything I say is Haber's understanding of Torah. Maybe it's dead wrong, but this is what I'm trying to give over, at least as food for thought. A typical woman could spend all day playing with a baby. A typical man will be bored stiff after the first hour. Now there are exceptions, and that's ultimately rooted in the fact that man and woman were one and they were shorn together, and therefore there are female characteristics in man and there are male characteristics in the woman, and each one has a different mizug of different male and different female characteristics. Yes, for sure. But I'm talking about prototypes. Is that just, you know, as a godless evolution would have us say, just societal? Absolutely not. There's a woman, there's a reason it's that way. Why is it that way? Because a woman is able to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu more through the Teva. Wow! How exciting this is to see a baby smile. How exciting it is to see a baby walk. Baruch Hashem, Bat Sheva is doing very well. She's walking all over the house. I'm excited too. But my wife could stare at that for hours and hours on end. I gotta get back to the Gemara. Whatever, I'm not trying to boast. It's just that's the way I am. I like it, let's move on. So let's put it all together. What is admiring HaKadosh Baruch Hu in nature if not trying to see a bigger picture? Wow! Majesty! And what is learning Gemara if not going into all of the nuances and the details. So perhaps we could say, and don't blame me, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said a very similar idea, much more beautifully presented than I could ever do, in his book called The Logic of the Heart and the Logic of the Mind. And he pointed out so beautifully that there are two parents, we hope, in every family, Bezrat Hashem, that should be able to raise the family properly. The man's job is to give over the mess, the details of Sinai, the word of Sinai, the details. The woman's job is to give over the message, because you could have all those details and you could miss the big picture. You didn't follow Rabbi Blachman and just read the Bible in English. You're not loving God when you're putting on tefillin. You're just putting it on. You're not connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu when you're keeping the laws of Shabbos. You're just following what it says in the Shmirah Shabbos Kol Chasa. It's just robotic. You need both. But let's say you just have the bigger picture. So that's what I call cardiac Judaism. I'm a Jew at heart. Basically, it means you do whatever you want. And you're not connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You need the details. The space shuttle will explode without those few tiles. You can't have the bigger picture without the details. The way Rabbi Soloveitchik put it, first the mitzvah act, then the great romance. But the great romance has to come. So I think Lanias Daiti, based on what Ron Soloveitchik said, that's the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu rigged two genders, male, female. A parent who gives over details, who focuses on the Torah Sheval Peh ideas, a parent who focuses on the generalities. Not chas v'shalom that the man doesn't need the generalities. That's what he learns perhaps from his wife. And not chas v'shalom that the woman doesn't need the details. Otherwise, we wouldn't teach Hilcha Shabbos in SFW. So, but they learn from each other, and they learn from the Torah as to how to put both of those together to become an Adam HaShalem, to become connected to God in both of those ways. Sorry, I went over. Thank you very much.